majority missionary culture to a majority mercenary culture in a single year. Another side effect of rapid growth is that many, if not a majority, of employees will be reporting to inexperienced managers. A systematic approach like that laid out in the Alliance can help those managers better align the personal values and missions of employees with the company culture. It can be tough to prioritize culture when other fires are burning. During the family and even tribe stages of blitzscaling, HR often doesn't exist as a separate department and might be outsourced to a professional employer organization like TriNet or left as a part-time job that an office manager or administrative assistant handles as a secondary priority. As a result, the unconscious habits and patterns of early employees often form and crystallize into an organizational culture without any experienced oversight. And even after the company adds an HR function, its first priority is usually to hire more employees as quickly as possible, rather than focus on culture and values. If an organization wants to make culture an HR priority, the founders and leadership need to make sure that the HR team is given the time and resources to do so, and that new hires are managed, evaluated, and rewarded accordingly. These mechanisms need to continue to evolve as the company grows and its needs evolve. Reed Hastings and Netflix are well known for the Netflix Culture Deck, a 100-plus slide presentation that explains Netflix's high-performance culture. Reed and Patty McCord created the Netflix Culture Deck to help filter out job candidates who wouldn't want to participate in the Netflix culture. But the deck isn't carved in stone. Netflix continues to revise it on a regular basis. One of the reasons for evolving your culture is the Ship of Theseus paradox. The ancient historian Plutarch coined the term in reference to the ship on which the mythical hero Theseus returned to Athens after slaying the Minotaur. As the legend goes, the Athenians had preserved the famous vessel by replacing broken parts with new wood, until at last, none of the original wood remained. Plutarch reported that philosophers argued strenuously and without resolution over whether the ship of replacement parts was still the ship of Theseus. Amusingly, the philosopher Thomas Hobbes complicated matters by asking what would happen if the original wood parts were preserved after being replaced and were then used to build a second ship. All companies are like the Ship of Theseus. Employees join, stay for one or more tours of duty, and leave, only to be replaced by new employees. A stable, low-growth company might persist for decades or even longer, slowly replacing employees but remaining the same size and retaining a strong sense of continuity. In other words, the planks of the ship remain essentially unchanged from decade to decade. In contrast, a blitzscaling company like Facebook might grow from the family to nation stage in a single decade, doubling or tripling in size each year, so that the employees who made up the entire ship on New Year's Day end up as a small minority by the following New Year's Eve. At the same time, as we discussed in Hire Ms. Right Now, Not Ms. Right, many early employees are likely to leave at some point along the journey, which means even fewer of the original planks are still part of the ship. Yet these changes are a necessary part of blitzscaling. You need new people with new skills as you grow. The people, the product, and the offices of a company can, will, and must change as it blitzscales. Culture is one of the few mechanisms that allow the ship to retain its essential identity. Culture is what helps Apple retain its Appleness with Steve Jobs gone, and Intuit retain its, well, intuitiveness, even as it shifted from selling packaged personal finance software to providing a cloud accounting suite. Organizational culture has become such a hot topic in this age of blitzscaling because culture is more important when there is rapid growth and change rather than stability and stasis. You have to walk a fine line as you evolve your culture. Evolve it too slowly and it will hold you back from adapting to new businesses and the changing world around you. Evolve it too quickly and the Ship of Theseus illusion breaks down, and people no longer feel like they belong. In the words of the Dutch historian Johan Huizinga, if we are to preserve culture, we must continue to create it. A lack of diversity and other cultural pitfalls. Given the popular emphasis on company culture, it's also important to offer some thoughts on the potential pitfalls that can come with trying to build a strong culture. First, there can be a fine line between a strong culture and a cult. By definition, culture is narrowing to some degree. Building culture into your hiring processes means that you're excluding people by design, and you have to be careful not to restrict your hiring to the point of total homogeneity. Successful organizations need a combination of conformity and diversity. The right kind of sameness, e.g., smart, driven, intelligent, hardworking, mission-driven, can give a company an edge, as was certainly the case at PayPal. But too much sameness can result in groupthink, bias, and stagnation. Far too many companies misinterpret what it means to hire for cultural fit. In many cases, this leads to teams that are heavy on young Caucasian men who went to a short list of elite colleges, which hinders the organization's ability to innovate or serve a broader market. But even without such problematic practices, hiring for fit should not mean asking, "Do you fit into this box?" For example, many startups have a work culture where employees come to the office after 10 a.m., work late, and spend evenings socializing together at bars. In other words, an extended version of college. If your startup has such a culture, you might avoid hiring employees who want to come in early and leave before 6 p.m., or who rarely socialize or go out at night. That might be good for cultural fit, but it also means that you won't hire people who don't drink alcohol for religious or other reasons, you won't hire employees who are parents, and you probably won't even hire employees who are married, or at least those who wish to remain married. Rather than hire people who fit your culture in superficial ways, whether based on gender or race or alma mater, hire people who are additive to your culture. When Belinda Johnson joined Airbnb in 2011, she brought a very different background and experience to the young company. The founders were in their 20s. Belinda had been a lawyer when they were still in diapers and had spent a dozen years as an executive at Yahoo. It was precisely these differences that helped both Belinda and Airbnb succeed as a team. Brian Chesky calls her Airbnb's Secretary of State, and her diplomacy and knowledge helped the firm develop productive relationships with regulators and municipalities. New hires are an opportunity to refine your culture and add to its capabilities. They should be compatible with your current culture, but also bring elements that help it change for the better. The art is in finding transplants that the organization's existing immune system doesn't reject. Blitzscaling companies are particularly susceptible to building a culture that lacks diversity because of their relentless emphasis on speed. The fastest and easiest way to hire is usually to ask employees to refer their friends. But hiring based on homophily, birds of a feather flock together, almost inevitably leads to homogeneity. Just as startups incur technical debt by taking shortcuts with their code, they can incur diversity debt by taking shortcuts with their hiring practices. This diversity debt is a serious problem for individual companies and for society as a whole. Homogeneity harms companies because groupthink reduces the resilience and adaptability of the companies, and it harms society if those many opportunities blitzscaling provides aren't fully open to all qualified people, whatever their gender, sexuality, religion, or ancestry. One of the ugliest manifestations of these problems is the culture of sexism and sexual harassment that has been uncovered at various companies. In almost every case, these problems arose because one or more employees who belonged to a demographic group that represented the overwhelming majority held power over employees who were in the minority. Many times, executives abused their power, setting a disgraceful example for other employees. This is absolutely unacceptable and begs for action. In 2017, for example, I called for the Decency Pledge to try to address the serious problems in the venture capital industry around men abusing their power and position to harm women and some men. Hopefully, most blitzscaling companies will never reach the point where their cultures tolerate such bad behavior, but the best way to ensure this is to build inclusive cultures from the very beginning. This is one area where it's insufficient to allow cultures to evolve organically. Even at the family stage, a company should be explicit about diversity and state in writing that it strives to be inclusive in terms of gender, sexuality, religion, ancestry, and age. And it should make diversity a priority in hiring, starting with its first 10 employees, and especially in core functions like product, engineering, and marketing. In the tribe and village stages, the rate at which you are adding employees will require a more systematic approach to diversity. we recommend implementing at least three key policies. First, measure your demographics and make that information transparent and available, both internally and externally. As with any metric, you can't manage what you don't measure. Second, institute the equivalent of the National Football League's Rooney Rule, which requires NFL teams to interview, but not necessarily hire, at least one minority candidate for any senior football operations position. And third, tie at least part of executive compensation to the company's progress toward its diversity goals. In an ideal universe, all companies would build diverse workforces from the start. But the more people a company employs, the more important diversity becomes. Don't wait to make diversity goals a priority. It's much harder to shift from a brogrammer haven to a truly inclusive culture when you're a 10,000-person company. Another pitfall is cultural hypocrisy. If you preach the gospel of your strong culture, you have to live up to it, or you'll be doing more harm than good. When you talk the talk but don't walk the walk, employees will recognize hypocrisy. Credibility has to be earned, not simply asserted. This is particularly true of founders, who typically have the moral authority within a startup, and of non-founder CEOs, whose position magnifies the impact of their words and actions. Founders and CEOs are cultural role models. If they don't exemplify the culture, it will inevitably weaken. The never-ending need for change. What do the 8 key transitions and 9 counterintuitive rules have in common? They reflect the fact that when you're blitzscaling, the need for change never stops. Just when you've managed a key transition or successfully applied a counterintuitive rule, the game board changes and you have to do it all again. No market remains valuable forever, which means that even companies that successfully reach the nation stage by dominating an important market have to keep searching for the next market in which to blitzscale. Every exciting new technology or market that once supported massive wealth creation eventually becomes a stable, boring industry. At various points in history, the cargo ship, railroad, and automobile industries spawned companies and innovations that changed the world and made generational fortunes. Today, they're largely sleepy backwaters, though occasionally companies like Tesla manage to revitalize them. A fate that is still better than irrelevance, but unlikely to hold many exciting opportunities for large-scale growth. The same pattern has played out on a smaller scale in Silicon Valley, where markets for dynamic random access memory, DRAM, hard drives, and personal computers allowed companies like Intel, Seagate, and Compaq to grow to massive value before becoming low-margin commodities. Intel continued to grow thanks to its shift to high-margin CPUs, while Seagate and Compaq languished, and in the case of Compaq, ended up being acquired and vanishing. The best entrepreneurs and companies use successful blitzscaling in one market to jump into another. Intel jumped from DRAMs to microprocessors and rode a second wave to even greater heights. Microsoft used its dominance in operating systems to develop the even more dominant Microsoft Office platform. Amazon's e-tail blitzscaling allowed it to become the leader in cloud computing with Amazon Web Services. Perhaps Facebook will do something similar with VR. The never-ending need for change should fill you with both fear and hope. Fear, because you can never rest or stand still. Hope, because new markets are always emerging, giving everyone from Silicon Valley to Shanghai and everywhere in between the opportunity to build nothing short of a new rocket ship. In Lewis Carroll's classic book, Through the Looking Glass, the Red Queen tells Alice, "Now here, you see, it takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place. If you want to get somewhere else, you must run at least twice as fast as that." Sometimes, blitzscaling a company might feel a bit like running as hard as you can, simply to end up in the same place. But the difference between our world and the Red Queen's is that blitzscaling is a race to build things that make the world a better place. Whether your new market will be machine learning, or a new kind of wireless computing, or something that hasn't been invented before, there's a word for the byproduct of blitzscaling. Progress. Part 5. The Broader Landscape of Blitzscaling. While many of the examples you've encountered throughout this book have been Silicon Valley technology companies, the principles of blitzscaling apply far beyond this specific domain. In this section, we'll focus on the broader landscape of blitzscaling, including how it works in other geographies and industries, and what it means for the future of our global economy. Because it is such an important topic, we'll devote an entire section of this chapter solely to examining blitzscaling in China. Blitzscaling beyond high tech. While blitzscaling is probably most applicable to high tech, its techniques can benefit any industry in which opportunities can demonstrate strong growth factors, market size, distribution, gross margins, and network effects, and overcome the growth limiters, lack of product market fit, and operational scalability. For example, consider the Spanish clothing retailer, Zara. Few industries could seem farther away from the world of internet companies like Google and Facebook. Yet while Zara's expansion took longer to get there, the company was founded in 1975, which, coincidentally, is the same year that Microsoft was founded. Its scale and dominance in its industry rival those of its high-tech equivalents and have made its founder, Amancio Ortega, the world's third richest man, behind Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates, but ahead of Warren Buffett. Zara plays in an enormous market. Global apparel sales in 2016 were over $1.4 trillion, and even though Zara's gross margin reached a 10-year low in 2017, it still stood at a robust 57%, versus 61% for Google and 35% for Amazon. Its global network of stores gives it broad distribution, and while apparel doesn't offer any strong network effects, clothing does command a fair amount of consumer loyalty, enabling Zara to lock in a degree of long-term advantage. What's even more important, however, is that Zara actually uses the techniques of blitzscaling to run its business. Speed is the foundation of Zara's fast fashion business strategy, which for decades can be summarized in a single sentence. Give customers what they want and get it to them faster than anyone else. Every aspect of Zara's business is organized around achieving that speed. The results are impressive. Zara takes only 2 weeks to develop a new product and get it into stores. The industry average is 6 months. And launches over 10,000 new designs per year, a rate several times that of competitors like H&M and Gap. Zara holds just 6 days of inventory, while rival H&M holds nearly 10 times as much. In the 1970s, Ortega established a rule that Zara had to fulfill apparel orders from its stores in less than 48 hours. Today, Zara still follows that rule, even though it has expanded from a local Spanish retailer into a global empire with stores in Africa and Asia. To achieve these results, Zara has found a way to balance addressing the growth limiter of operational scalability while following the counterintuitive rules to embrace chaos and do things that don't scale. Given its massive scale, you would expect Zara to turn to China for help with improving its margins, in the way that Apple did with the iPhone. But unlike its competitors, Zara still manufactures most of its clothing in Spain. Thanks to its financial might, Zara was able to build 14 highly automated factories in Spain, where robots create greige goods, newly manufactured clothes that haven't been whitened and dyed. Zara then uses a partner network of more than 300 small shops in Spain and Portugal to process those greige goods into finished apparel. While the labor costs might be higher than in China, and thus less efficient, the payoff is incredible responsiveness and speed. Responsive manufacturing is critical to Zara's business model. Apparel is designed by small teams in Zara's design center, where designers work with pattern makers and commercial sales specialists. Feedback comes in daily from Zara's store managers. That feedback is analyzed by the sales specialists and then presented to the designers and pattern makers, who start sketching designs on the spot and create, on average, an astonishing 3 new items per day. The designs are then dispatched to those factories for manufacturing and on to partner shops for finishing. Zara's logistics model continues this preference for responsiveness over efficiency. Zara products are distributed in small batches, which require more frequent shipments. The logistics costs are higher, but this allows Zara to get its clothes to its stores in less than 24 hours for Europe, the Middle East, and America, and in less than 48 hours for Asia and Latin America. This focus on speed comes directly from the founder and animates the entire organization. In a 2013 profile, Fortune told the story of how, stopped at a traffic light, Ortega spotted a young motorcyclist wearing a jean jacket covered in 1970s-style patches. Ortega grabbed his cell phone, called an aide, described the jacket over the phone, and ordered the aide to get the design into production. Loreto Garcia, the head of Zara's women's trends department, explained the need to be lightning fast in responding to trends when she told Fortune, "What seems great today, in 2 weeks, is the worst idea ever." Despite all the chaos and the inefficiency of manufacturing and shipping in small batches, Zara's gross margins continue to exceed those of its competitors H&M, 55%, and Gap, 29%. That's because all that inefficiency incurred in the pursuit of speed allows Zara to avoid one of the biggest drags on gross margin for almost any apparel company, overstock of designs that failed to sell. Ortega devised this model when he was 16 years old. Don't order inventory and hope it sells. Instead, figure out what people want and then make it. Another example of how blitzscaling applies to a completely different type of business is the rapid rise of the shale oil and natural gas industry in the United States during the 2000s. The energy sector scores well on the growth factors we've defined. Oil and gas is an enormous high-margin industry with a very efficient distribution system. And while the shale industry doesn't feature many network effects, it has its own source of powerful long-term competitive advantage. In the energy industry, rather than buy land outright, the usual practice is to lease the drilling rights for 99 years for a combination of guaranteed lease payments and royalties. This means that leasing the right land is tantamount to holding an unbreakable monopoly on the oil and gas underneath that land, at least for the term of the lease. Blitzscaling allowed shale companies to grow at an amazing rate. In 2002, leading shale player Chesapeake Energy reported revenues of $738 million. Just 4 years later, Chesapeake reported revenues of $7.3 billion and was added to the S&P 500. That's an order of magnitude of growth in the time it takes to go through high school. Chesapeake's co-founders, the late Aubrey McClendon and his partner Tom Ward, didn't have the usual industry background in exploration or refining. Instead of working drilling rigs or operating refineries, McClendon and Ward were landmen, specialists who went out into the field to negotiate mineral rights leases with landowners. This expertise would be key to their blitzscaling effort. In the late 1990s, the combination of horizontal drilling and improved hydraulic fracturing techniques, fracking, made extracting hydrocarbons from shale rock formations economically feasible for the first time. Essentially, energy companies could drill horizontal shafts into rock formations and then pump high-pressure liquids into the wells to fracture the rock and release more oil and gas. Because traditional drilling techniques didn't work on shale rock formations, the land above those formations had never been leased, which meant that when fracking made those hydrocarbons accessible for the first time, the market to acquire those mineral rights was completely wide open. While Chesapeake wasn't the first company to employ fracking, it was in fact Mitchell Energy, which brought fracking to the Barnett Shale Formation in Texas in 1997. It combined this technology innovation with McClendon's business innovation to become the fastest growing energy company in history. Chesapeake moved faster than any other company in its industry, deploying an army of landmen to aggressively lease as much land as possible, with instructions to pay whatever was necessary, without knowing whether the gas deposits would justify the price. Hiring an army of landmen and paying top dollar for leases, sight unseen, seemed inefficient, until the wells started producing. Chesapeake's willingness to blitzscale paid off as improvements in fracking technology made its wells insanely profitable. At first. The case of McClendon and Chesapeake also illustrates the inherent risks of sacrificing efficiency in the name of hypergrowth. Blitzscaling can lead to big wins and big losses, sometimes at the same company. Chesapeake continued to borrow money to lease more land at ever higher prices. McClendon acted as though his blitzscaling strategy was guaranteed to succeed, and Chesapeake was hit hard by the global recession of 2008. After peaking at $62.40 per share in June 2008, its stock price has declined sharply, falling as low as $2.61 in early 2016. In 2017, it traded between $4 and $8 per share. McClendon had taken on a lot of risk in his personal finances as well, borrowing money to buy Chesapeake stock. A margin call in 2008 forced him to sell 94% of his Chesapeake stock at a massive loss. McClendon was eventually forced to step down from his position as CEO of Chesapeake in 2013, but remained a resolute blitzscaler. At the time of his death in 2016, McClendon was running American Energy Partners, a company he founded after his departure from Chesapeake and for which he had raised $15 billion from investors. Even if you're not able to fully apply the business model patterns of software-driven high-tech to your industry, a careful analysis of growth factors and growth limiters might just show you where to find an opportunity to blitzscale and reap the associated rewards. After all, if you can blitzscale t-shirts and oil wells, you might very well be able to blitzscale any business. Blitzscaling within a larger organization. While the hypergrowth of blitzscaling is often synonymous with scrappy startups, blitzscaling can take place within larger, established organizations as well. None of the growth factors or limiters, and none of the proven patterns or business models, require a business to be an independently owned, privately held, venture-backed corporation. Even if your organization can't offer stock options that will make your employees rich if your blitzscaling is successful, you can and should adopt and adapt the lessons of blitzscaling to help you achieve rapid growth and first scaler advantage. Trying to blitzscale within a larger organization has both advantages and disadvantages over doing so within a startup. It's critical to be realistic. Startups have some inherent advantages when it comes to blitzscaling. Blitzscaling is all about speed and risk-taking, and with far less to lose, startups are much more nimble. Established companies that want to blitzscale need to find major advantages to overcome their inherent disadvantages in speed and risk-taking. Advantage number one, scale. This might sound obvious, but there are some opportunities you can only tackle if you already have the scale that comes with being a large, established player. For example, Amazon couldn't have launched Amazon Web Services, AWS, without achieving massive scale in its data centers and becoming the world leader in managing those data centers. Trying to build that product from scratch, without being able to leverage Amazon's economies of scale and reputation for operational excellence, would have been nearly impossible. Even today, AWS's main competitors come from other scale companies like Microsoft, Google, and IBM. Outside of tech, scale can be an even bigger advantage. When Quicken Loans launched Rocket Mortgage, which provides mortgages online with a decision in less than 10 minutes, Rocket Mortgage was able to tap into Quicken Loans' consumer marketing expertise, including a Super Bowl ad, to acquire customers, and the company's existing financial relationships to fund those mortgages. As a result, in its first full year of operation, 2016, Rocket Mortgage originated $7 billion in loans, which would rank it in the top 30 of all mortgage lenders in the country if it was an independent company, and which helped push Quicken Loans' overall closed loan volume to $96 billion, up sharply from $79 billion in 2015. On the other hand, if a startup can play the same game, scale may not provide a significant advantage unless there is a massive difference in scale. For example, when Airbnb was blitzscaling, it was competing with HomeAway, an established player that had much greater scale. However, HomeAway had achieved its scale via a string of 21 acquisitions, which meant that all of its acquisitions were running on different technology platforms and serving different clientels. Indeed, HomeAway's scale was actually a disadvantage. HomeAway itself was later acquired by Expedia as part of that company's response to the competitive threat of Airbnb. Advantage number two, iteration. Another advantage that established companies have is the ability to make multiple iterative blitzscaling attempts. Blitzscaling is a risky strategy, and you might not achieve success on the first try. You need to have enough capital to stay in the game. Microsoft was famed for its ability to iterate its way from knockoff products to market dominance. The first and second versions of Microsoft Windows were unsuccessful attempts to copy Apple's Macintosh operating system. The third version, while still inferior to its inspiration, was good enough, and Microsoft unleashed a marketing blitz for follow-up versions such as Windows 95 and Windows NT that carried them to dominance. Microsoft later repeated this strategy with its Xbox business, which evolved from the Xbox to the Xbox 360 to today's Xbox One. To borrow an analogy from sports, you may need to take repeated shots on goal before scoring. Established players have a much easier time financing multiple shots on goal. Nor is this advantage limited to technology. In the shale oil industry, financial wherewithal played a major role in the success of pioneers like Chesapeake Energy. The late Aubrey McClendon told Rolling Stone in 2012, "To be able to borrow money for 10 years and ride out boom and bust cycles was almost as important an insight as horizontal drilling. If something didn't work for a little bit of time, we could regroup and find something that did work." Advantage number 3, longevity. While the ability to undertake multiple attempts at blitzscaling is an advantage, so is the ability to be patient with a single attempt. Larger companies can, if they have patient shareholders, have longer time horizons than startups, which need to show immediate results to continue raising money. Google often plays this long game with technologies ranging from self-driving cars to a cure for aging. Facebook is also playing the long game with Oculus Rift and VR. The key is knowing when to scale up. Microsoft tried to scale smartphones too early with Windows CE. As it turns out, the modern smartphone only became practical once Moore's Law made mobile CPUs powerful enough and Apple combined software with capacitive touchscreens, Corning's damage-resistant Gorilla Glass, and high-volume Chinese manufacturing. Advantage number 4, mergers and acquisitions, M&A. One final advantage that established players have is the ability to use acquisitions to drive blitzscaling. Acquiring a business that is already blitzscaling or has the potential to blitzscale can transform an existing company. Priceline, for example, best known for its name-your-price airfares, executed this strategy to perfection when it acquired Booking.com, allowing it to achieve a lasting advantage in the hotel booking market. Many American consumers who are only familiar with Priceline because of its catchy Priceline Negotiator commercials starring the actor William Shatner probably have no idea that nearly two-thirds of Priceline's revenues come from hotel bookings outside the United States. In 2015, Priceline actually had the highest 10-year return of any stock in the Fortune 500. As with direct blitzscaling, succeeding with an M&A strategy requires having a rare or unique insight into the market. Had all the players in the travel space known the value of online hotel booking, Priceline wouldn't have been able to afford the Booking.com acquisition. Established players can also use a string of acquisitions to blitzscale, provided they do a better job of integration than HomeAway did. For example, Facebook's acquisitions of Instagram and WhatsApp helped it fend off a dangerous competitor in Snap to achieve a dominant position in social networking for a younger generation. But established companies also have a number of disadvantages, beyond simply being less quick and nimble, to take into account when implementing a blitzscaling strategy. Disadvantage number 1, incentives. A major issue faced by established players is that the incentives tend to favor cautious expansion rather than aggressive blitzscaling. Successful companies generally assume that they already have something valuable, which means risk-taking tends to be penalized. If you make the play and fail, you've destroyed a valuable thing. That's not something a startup faces. A startup is dead by default, so there's nothing to lose. Companies also face pressures from shareholders, analysts, and the press. The thing is, big company leaders are not wrong to be cautious. A large and public failure can tank an established player's stock price and its reputation. Moreover, the potential rewards have to be huge to matter. A $10 million opportunity that a startup might see as a life-changing bet is pocket change to a big company. The incentives that drive individual employees can also have a negative impact on blitzscaling attempts inside an established company. The employee or executive who proposes a risky blitzscaling initiative is the one who stands to gain the most, promotions, bonuses, clout, etc., from its success. In contrast, other employees gain little from that success and might even end up losing if that success allows its champion to jump over them for promotions or bonuses. And if the initiative is unsuccessful and costs the company a large sum of money, its employees all bear the cost of failure as well. Is it any wonder that so many bold initiatives are killed in committee? Disadvantage number 2, unstaged commitment. Another largely self-inflicted disadvantage for large companies is the inability or unwillingness to stage their investments. This results from internal incentives, which tend to reward managers based on the revenues that they oversee, while penalizing failure and undervaluing growth opportunities. Staged investments let managers minimize their company's downsides when performing experiments. But since most such experiments fail, big company managers try to reduce the risk of failure by committing more resources. Unfortunately, most blitzscaling opportunities are so risky and uncertain and require so much capital to succeed that making an unstaged commitment effectively bets the company. That may not be a big deal to a startup, which must succeed or die, but it is a very big deal for a going concern whose business might otherwise chug along profitably for years or even decades. Senior managers may also, for ego reasons, prefer splashy announcements and major commitments to small experiments that can be blitzscaled if successful. Larger companies also impose a great deal more managerial overhead. By the time you get approval on a proposal, competitors might have already locked up the market. It should come as no surprise that one big company that continues to value and encourage staged commitments and experiments is Amazon. Jeff Bezos talked about this in one of his famed shareholder letters. Bezos wants to make sure that Amazon continues to have the startup mindset, which he calls day one. Bezos writes, "Staying in day one requires you to experiment patiently, accept failures, plant seeds, protect saplings, and double down when you see customer delight." Disadvantage number three, public market pressure. Finally, established companies that are publicly traded face an additional set of pressures to deliver short-term, i.e. quarterly, financial results. Blitzscaling generally requires sacrificing short-term efficiency, and thus financial results, to achieve long-term value creation. Privately held companies are usually closely held. This can make it easier to get the major shareholders to agree on a risky long-term investment, if you have shareholders who are willing to incur risk for a chance at a much greater reward. But a widely held public company may face activist investors and other such shareholder rebellions if it attempts to carry out a blitzscaling strategy. This could even lead to the worst of possibilities, incurring the initial expense of blitzscaling without the necessary commitment and follow-through to reap the long-term rewards. Many publicly traded blitzscalers like Google and Facebook have tried to avoid public market pressure by issuing two classes of stock, so that decision-making authority is vested in a small number of people, i.e. Larry, Sergey, and Mark. With these advantages and disadvantages in mind, here are a few specific management techniques or hacks that large companies can use when they set out to blitzscale. Blitzscaling hacks. One productive hack to help your existing company blitzscale is to find ways to leverage people and businesses with prior blitzscaling experience. One obvious play is to partner with a blitzscaling startup. For example, GM responded to the rise of Uber and the corresponding threat it represents to the market for cars for human drivers by investing $500 million in Lyft, Uber's blitzscaling rival. GM also hedged its bets by acquiring Cruise for its self-driving car technology. A less obvious technique is to leverage the knowledge of venture capitalists. Venture capitalists are keen fans of blitzscaling and the returns it brings, even if they didn't know the specific term before the book came out. If you ask them to become minority investors in your project, they will provide a realistic assessment of your situation. For example, many large companies misprice their own assets or overvalue their own advantages and attempt to blitzscale even if an objective observer would consider the attempt ill-advised. Approaching venture capitalists is a quick way to get a sense of how knowledgeable professionals assess the value of your assets. One final way to mitigate the inherent pitfalls of blitzscaling within a larger organization is to treat the new initiative as a company within a company. Once your blitzscaling project is underway, you will need to manage it differently than your regular projects. Blitzscaling's increased pace and decreased efficiency can seem reckless and wasteful when evaluated against conventional initiatives that are designed to provide steady growth. As a result, a blitzscaling project needs to be insulated from the rest of the company so that the executive in charge can run it effectively. The classic example is Steve Jobs' approach to managing the original Macintosh team, which had separate offices that were off-limits to regular Apple employees. More recently, Larry Page applied this same technique to Android by allowing Andy Rubin's team to work in separate offices, Google employee badges didn't grant access to Android offices and adopt different hiring practices from those of the parent company. Much the same was true for the PlayStation project at Sony, the Kindle project at Amazon, and the Watson team at IBM. Blitzscaling beyond business. While we focused on the application of blitzscaling in the world of business, the basic principle of sacrificing efficiency for speed in the face of uncertainty can be applied in just about any context. Let's consider how the growth factors and growth limiters of blitzscaling translate to non-business settings. Market size. In the nonprofit world, we need to find new measures of market size since we can't rely on financial metrics like revenue. Often, the best measure might simply be the number of people whose lives are improved, but other measures such as years of healthy life or metric tons of carbon sequestered could also serve this role. While the metrics might change, the principle of market size still applies. Without a large market, it makes little sense to blitzscale. One of the main reasons that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation decided to tackle malaria prevention and treatment is the enormous size of the malaria market. In 2012, 207 million people suffered from the disease and 627,000 died from it, with 77% of those deaths affecting children under the age of 5. Those figures include a 42% reduction in annual deaths from 2000 to 2012, thanks in part to the efforts of the Gates Foundation. That is a large market where the ability to blitzscale makes a huge impact. Distribution. Distribution is just as critical outside of the business context as it is for profit-seeking companies. No matter how potentially effective your product, whether that product is a social service, a political candidate, or anything else, is at improving the lives of those who adopt it, its impact is directly proportional to your ability to execute an effective distribution strategy. The Mozilla Foundation wasn't the only open source organization to create a web browser, Firefox, but it was the only nonprofit organization that was able to leverage distribution to achieve a leading market share. In 2008, Barack Obama won the presidency in part because his campaign was the first to leverage the distribution possibilities of the internet, including leveraging existing grassroots networks and achieving virality via social media. Gross margin. Since many nonprofits don't charge the people they serve, gross margin doesn't apply. However, we can use metrics that align with the spirit of gross margin, such as economic impact. At a high level, gross margin is a measure of impact per dollar, and the greater the impact per dollar, the more amenable a not-for-profit business should be to blitzscaling. For example, the International Civil Society Support estimates that each $1 spent on malaria prevention and treatment generates $20 of economic benefit, with insecticide-impregnated mosquito bed nets representing the single most cost-effective intervention. That's the kind of impact that compares favorably even to software gross margins. Network effects. Network effects are relatively rare in the nonprofit world. While there are mega NGOs such as the Red Cross and the United Way, their market position is largely due to economies of scale rather than true network effects. But it is still worth considering whether or not it is possible to tap into network effects, since doing so can have such a major impact. For example, Sal Khan's Khan Academy began when Sal started tutoring one of his young cousins over the internet. When other cousins started signing up, he decided to post his lectures on YouTube so that anyone in the world could use them. The critical decision to leverage the YouTube platform meant that Khan Academy had both an enormous market, anyone who could access YouTube, which is to say, most of humanity, and a powerful distribution platform. Anyone searching for educational content on YouTube was likely to run across Khan Academy. As the Khan Academy gained a massive user base, it began to benefit from both indirect and standard-based network effects. Educators began incorporating Khan Academy videos into their official curriculum and creating lesson plans that they shared with other educators. Today, the Khan Academy is used by 40 million students and 2 million educators every month. The entire United States has only 50.7 million K-12 students, and volunteers have translated its videos into 36 languages. Lack of product market fit. In the case of for-profit businesses, the remorseless logic of the market economy quickly eliminates companies that fail to achieve product market fit, Without the ability to achieve traction, businesses lack the revenue to survive and have little ability to raise additional funding from investors. In contrast, nonprofits often receive grants and donations for non-economic reasons, and the flow of funds isn't always correlated with the effectiveness of the organization being funded. The clients are the people it serves, but the customers are the funders. Yet product market fit is still important for those organizations if they want to blitzscale. In general, the more effectively a nonprofit organization serves its clients, the better it is able to raise more money from customers. Charity Water is a nonprofit that provides clean, safe drinking water to people in developing nations. It is also a model of product market fit for its users, who have benefited from the more than 23,000 water projects it has funded, and for its funders, who can see photos of the wells it builds and know that 100% of their donations will go to fund those projects. The organization's operating costs are covered by foundations and sponsors. As a result, in the decade since its founding in 2006, Charity Water has raised over $252 million from more than 300,000 individual donors. Operational scalability. If anything, operational scalability is a bigger challenge outside the business world. As a business scales, it usually has the revenues or VC dollars to invest heavily in a scalable infrastructure or to hire additional employees. The business world is also full of companies that have successfully scaled, which means that it is easier to bring in employees who can help you manage rapid growth. In contrast, nonprofits usually don't have the same financial capital and certainly don't have access to the same kind of experienced human capital. This places a greater premium on designing a business model that does not require as many resources to scale, as in the case of an open source organization like the Mozilla Foundation. Aside from the growth factors and growth limiters, one other major potential difference is how nonprofits and impact organizations look at competition. In the business world, and certain non-business organizations like political campaigns, competition, specifically beating that competition, is one of the most important motivations for blitzscaling. In contrast, the Gates Foundation would welcome another major player that spent billions of dollars trying to beat the Gates Foundation to achieving the goal of malaria eradication. This may help explain why blitzscaling has been relatively less common in the world beyond business. However, given the scale of the challenges before us today, from climate change to poverty to an education system in need of reform, we believe that the time is ripe to consider how to apply scalable technology solutions to traditionally unscalable issues. Let's examine two very specific, but very different examples to see some of the ways in which you can apply the principles of blitzscaling beyond business. Example number one, Dress for Success. Dress for Success, DFS, helps low-income women get jobs by providing them with donated professional attire and coaching them through the interview process. 99% of its operating funds come from grants, government funding, and donations. Without investor dollars or revenues to fund expansion, DFS founder Nancy Lublin had to find clever ways to circumvent the challenges of operational scalability without consuming cash. One particularly clever strategy was to leverage its infrastructure limitations to get around the limitations in manpower. To achieve scale, DFS needed to find a way to screen potential clients to ensure the organization was serving those who most needed it, and staff its clothing shop, both of which would normally require either paid employees or extensive recruiting of volunteers. Instead, Lublin partnered with organizations like domestic violence shelters that were serving the same clients and accomplished both at zero cost. DFS only accepted clients who were referred by partners. In exchange, those partners were required to provide volunteers to help staff the shops. This allowed DFS to scale the number of people it served along with the workforce needed to provide that service, all without costing it a dime. Lublin also leveraged the power of an innovative distribution model by franchising DFS. Anyone who wanted to start a DFS shop was invited to fly to New York and stay on a futon in her apartment. She then trained those entrepreneurs and sent them back to their hometowns to start up new DFS shops. When Lublin left DFS in 2002, she had expanded the organization to 76 shops. Today, DFS has expanded into 21 different countries and helped nearly 1 million women. Example number 2, Barack Obama for president. In 2008, the presidential campaign of Barack Obama used the power of blitzscaling, especially business model innovation, and the tools of Silicon Valley to catapult a little-known first-term senator from Illinois to the White House, despite running against a series of prominent national politicians, including former First Lady and fellow senator Hillary Clinton. The key business model innovation behind Barack Obama's long-shot campaign for the presidency was an unprecedented use of connectivity to enable and coordinate a decentralized movement. Obama announced his candidacy on February 10, 2007. According to campaign advisor Steve Spinner, the campaign grew from 0 to 700 employees and orders of magnitude more volunteers in a single year. The key to this rapid growth was the use of technology to leverage large existing networks and achieve powerful distribution. First, Obama focused on raising small donations from individuals via the internet rather than raising large donations from well-heeled traditional Democratic Party donors. This was partially out of necessity since he was running for the Democratic nomination against Hillary Clinton, who was both viewed as a presumptive favorite and had deep relationships with big donors from her years in the White House and the Senate. But, as it turned out, this new business model allowed Obama to raise more money than any previous candidate, more than $650 million in campaign contributions, nearly $300 million more than the previous record, which had been set by President George W. Bush during his 2004 re-election campaign. Over half that amount came from donations of less than $200. In contrast, only 27% of the money raised during the 2004 election cycle came from small donors. Second, the Obama campaign also utilized technology to build and manage an army of volunteers to get out the vote. Here, the Obama campaign benefited from a remarkable piece of luck. Shortly before announcing his candidacy, the campaign reached out to the young social network Facebook to set up an official page. The person they reached, Facebook co-founder Chris Hughes, became convinced that Barack Obama could win the presidency and change the world, and Hughes left Facebook to join the campaign. Hughes brought with him his personal experiences working at one of the world's great blitzscaling companies and moved quickly to apply the tools of Silicon Valley to the Obama campaign. Hughes and his team ended up creating three key tools that leveraged growth factors to help Obama win the election. The first was my.barackobama.com, or MyBO for short. MyBO was a social network that leveraged existing networks of Obama supporters, allowing them to connect with one another, as well as create groups, plan events, and raise funds. Over the course of the campaign, volunteers used MyBO to create 2 million profiles, host 200,000 offline events, and raise $30 million. The second tool was the neighbor-to-neighbor canvassing tool. When MyBO users logged in, neighbor-to-neighbor provided a list of undecided voters they could call or visit. Neighbor-to-neighbor tapped into online databases to match volunteers with people they would likely connect with, taking into account factors like age, profession, languages spoken, and military service. Neighbor-to-neighbor generated some 8 million calls and tremendous word of mouth. The final tool was the Vote for Change voter registration site, which automatically sorted out the fiendishly complicated nest of local voter registration rules to help potential Obama voters register correctly. For example, college students would log in and be asked for the location of both their college and childhood home. Vote for Change would then help them register in the state where a student's vote was more badly needed. During the campaign, Vote for Change helped 1 million people register to vote, roughly the same number that 2,000 paid staff could handle using the old-fashioned door-to-door model. On Tuesday, November 4, 2008, Barack Obama was elected the 44th President of the United States of America. Thanks in part to the blitzscaling techniques his campaign employed, he received over 69 million votes, still a record for any U.S. presidential candidate. As these examples demonstrate, blitzscaling can be as powerful a tool for social impact and change as it can be for building a massively profitable business. It's not easy. You'll need either access to significant capital, as we saw with Barack Obama's 2008 presidential campaign, the ability to leverage the contributions of a community or another existing network, as we saw with Dress for Success, or both. But if you are able to support this kind of rapid growth, the lessons of blitzscaling can help you manage the strains of that growth and maximize the impact you have on the world. Blitzscaling in Greater Silicon Valley. One of the interesting developments in the business world over the past decade is how other high-tech ecosystems on the Pacific coast of the United States have become more tightly integrated with Silicon Valley. For most of the 20th century, Seattle, Los Angeles, and Silicon Valley were very different and differentiated industry hubs. While Silicon Valley specialized in computers, Seattle and Los Angeles both had strong aerospace and defense industries, and each ecosystem also boasted its own market leadership positions in coffee, Seattle, and the entertainment industry, Los Angeles. But in the 21st century, Seattle and Los Angeles have also become home to high-tech ecosystems that are increasingly tied to Silicon Valley. In a 2017 article titled, How America's Two Tech Hubs Are Converging, The Economist argued that Seattle and Silicon Valley were becoming increasingly intertwined, citing as evidence the fact that most of the venture capital investment in Seattle startups has come from Silicon Valley VC firms, and that about 30 Silicon Valley firms had opened Seattle offices to tap into that city's plentiful supply of computer scientists. While Seattle's two dominant blitzscalers, Amazon and Microsoft, have thousands of employees working in Silicon Valley. Meanwhile, Seattle's Amazon Web Services has become the cloud computing platform of choice for Silicon Valley startups and scale-ups. Los Angeles has also seen impressive growth as a startup and scale-up hub. According to the research firm CB Insights, Los Angeles-based startups took in $3 billion in funding in 2016, up sixfold since 2012. The LA ecosystem, including the so-called Silicon Beach area along the Pacific coastline, has produced a number of important companies, including Snap and SpaceX, each of which is worth over $10 billion, as well as other success stories like Dollar Shave Club. It is worth noting that Snap's founders met while studying at Stanford, that SpaceX was founded by former San Franciscan Elon Musk, and that the majority of their investors were Silicon Valley venture capital firms like Lightspeed, Founders Fund, and Venrock. Like Seattle, Los Angeles is an operations base for major Silicon Valley companies such as Google. These relationships aren't particularly surprising when you consider that both Seattle and Los Angeles are close enough to Silicon Valley to allow the intertwining of their networks of capital, talent, and learning. Either a short flight, Seattle is 2 hours away, Los Angeles just an hour, or a 6-hour drive from LA with plenty of Tesla superchargers along I-5 so that venture capitalists can make the journey. This helps to integrate the capital networks. It's easy for Silicon Valley investors to invest in Seattle and Los Angeles-based deals because they can simply fly in and out for board meetings. This also helps integrate the talent networks since entrepreneurs can easily travel between hubs to develop and maintain relationships and to share insights and learning face-to-face. For example, geography allows Elon Musk to run both Tesla, Silicon Valley, and SpaceX, Los Angeles. Seattle and Los Angeles also offer good quality of life benefits to individual professionals, since they are major cultural centers and popular tourist destinations, with less expensive housing markets than Silicon Valley, though hardly inexpensive. These ties will likely get even closer if the cities are connected via additional transportation links, like high-speed rail or Elon's proposed Hyperloop, or with the advent of self-driving cars, all of which would make travel and commuting between these cities and Silicon Valley faster and cheaper. Thus, LA and Seattle are becoming increasingly fertile grounds for entrepreneurship and good places to set up a company that you are planning on blitzscaling. It will be interesting to see if Amazon's HQ2 project to set up a second headquarters, Amazon intends to spend $5 billion to construct a new corporate campus that will accommodate 50,000 employees, ends up expanding Greater Silicon Valley even further and farther. Moody's picked Austin as the most likely city to be chosen, while the New York Times believed Denver to have a good chance. Either would be a logical expansion point given the long-standing pattern of migration from Silicon Valley to Colorado and the nerd bird flights that Southwest operates between San Jose and Austin. Other blitzscaling regions to watch. Within the United States, cities like Boston and Austin have emerged as powerful tech hubs, followed more recently by Boulder, Colorado, and even New York City. Over in Europe, cities like London, Stockholm, and Berlin, where the Somver brothers Rocket Internet is attempting to industrialize blitzscaling as a business model, with notable successes and failures, have begun producing interesting companies as well. According to research at Wharton, Stockholm actually produces the second highest number of billion-dollar unicorn startups after Silicon Valley itself. Around 65% of working age, 18 to 64 years old,